Welcome to the third series of the Reworked podcast, brought to you by diversity consultancy EW Group. I'm Rachel Wilson, Managing Director. While I'm on maternity leave, you'll be in the safe hands of our special guest hosts, who each fortnight will be speaking to CEOs, HR leaders, and workplace activists about the steps they are taking to reform and rework organisational culture.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the EW Group Reworked podcast. I'm Catherine Manser and I'm very excited to be joined today by Winston Ben Clements, Diversity and Inclusion Consultant. You may have seen Winston delivering his TEDx talk on unconscious bias entitled, Who Are You Excluding? So hi Winston, thanks very much for joining us today.
Yeah, awesome to be here, Catherine. I know we've been planning this for a while.
Yeah, it's good to finally be chatting. So I was lucky enough to see you give a keynote speech on resilience earlier this year, which was super insightful and very engaging. Tell me a bit more about the type of work you do and what you set out to achieve.
Yeah, thanks. So I guess if I visualize my work, I feel like it falls into two buckets. Initially, when I got into public speaking and into doing TEDx talks and those kind of things, it was more me sharing a personal story, because I guess maybe the unique thing about me is I was born with a condition known as osteogenesis imperfecta, mm-hmm. which is a mouthful, but just means brittle bone disorder. And so the interesting or maybe different thing there is I just have these bones that break a lot easier than the average person. So I think we worked out by the age of 12, I'd fractured 150 times, which is like average a broken bone every month. And I don't know if you've had the unfortunate experience of breaking anything, but it's not fun.
I'm very lucky and fortunate to say I have not.
Yes, keep it that way.
I can't even begin to imagine.
and so with that, like, so not only were my bones affected, but it also because your skeleton is like your whole bone structure. So because it's a developmental condition of bones, so the bones are fragile is one, and then also the bones don't grow and develop as they would. So you've seen me, but there might be people listening to this who've not come across me before. So I'm probably about 3.5 feet I was going to say in length, tall, 3.5 feet tall. and I use a wheelchair. And so when I started speaking and sharing my personal story, resilience felt like, you know, a good, I guess, umbrella topic to put it under, because it's more in the, I guess you could call it inspirational category, but I also like to be super practical with the tips and the things that have helped me, you know, navigate my condition, navigate academia, and then now like navigate this career as a corporate speaker trainer. And then like the second bucket is to do with diversity and inclusion. And I guess that was kind of born out of, if I'm honest, frustration when I worked in corporate and, you know, just being of, so I'm Black, so being of an ethnic minority and sort of starting to realize that actually being technically gifted. So I've studied computer science and, you know, in my opinion, I'm a pretty good computer programmer. Yeah. and then so like going into these big companies and realizing that actually being a good programmer is not good enough. There's almost like the invisible game and like all these relationships and all these things that you have to do in order to get the promotion and those kinds of things and to progress. And so I guess I saw and I realized, well, if someone like me is experiencing, you know, this kind of challenge, mm-hmm. because this is not what you're taught at school. You're taught how to program, you're not taught how to, you know, build certain types of relationships and to be strategic and tactical. So I thought perhaps if I'm experiencing this, then maybe there's other people from diverse communities who are experiencing this as well. And so out of this frustration, it just kind of led me to researching more about D&I, and particularly initially with the focus on recruitment and helping people with certain backgrounds navigate that corporate hierarchy more successfully.
Yeah, sure. It's, I mean, it's obviously a very unique personal experience that you've had, what do you find when you're giving talks or speeches? What do you find are the biggest lessons that people take away from what you're saying?
Yeah, good question. Hopefully all of it. Hopefully they're paying attention.
I'm sure.
So maybe a good example, because I've done two TEDx talks actually, and one was resilience, the other one was the unconscious bias one, which you mentioned at the start. So with the resilience one that I did, that was a couple of years ago, maybe 2-3 years. It was only a small event. It was TEDx Chichester, but as soon as it got posted on YouTube, it kind of got a lot of interest and traction. Of course, people in my community and my networks, they shared it a lot to support me. And then I started getting like messages from people all over the world. Catherine had, you know, people from Cuba and Chile and like the Fiji Islands, all these places which I didn't even know. Okay, I probably knew they existed, but I just never had any connection. And, you know, like, yeah, people would say things like, you know, just seeing someone like me on the stage, someone who appears to have had a lot of challenges in life, just being on the stage, speaking so confidently, gave them the confidence to, you know, to feel like they could achieve something, or like that the thing that they were facing in that moment wasn't such a big obstacle.
Yeah.
The kind of, I guess, perspective is one of the things that comes out. I was going to say the strangest one, the most unique one was like, I think it was one of those messages that I got from, I think it was Mexico or someone, and someone said like they went and they taught themselves English, just a little bit of English, so that they could understand what I was saying in my first TED talk. So it inspired them to go and learn a bit of English because they were so inspired. They just initially didn't know what I was talking about, so they just took it upon themselves to do that. So yeah, it's those kind of things. With resilience, there's a lot of like reframing perspective, controlling the things that you can control, and I also talk a lot about the different components of resilience, because it's becoming a bit of a buzzword. Everyone's teaching resilience, but I like to break it down practically. You know, there's the four components of resilience, that I believe if you work on each one of those four, then you've got a chance of, you know, developing that muscle, so to speak.
Yeah, that's great. And were those four components of resilience, kind of, did you identify those yourself early on, when you were working in the corporate world, or was it even before then?
Yeah, good question. I think there were things which, because initially in my talk, I was just telling my story. Literally, I was just saying, like, hey, this is what happened at school, this is what happened at work, and now I'm a speaker, like, hurrah. So that was pretty much my talk. And then as soon as I started to, like, link it to resilience, I then decided to do a lot of reading around resilience, so that it's not just, you know, me sharing one perspective, but it's me sharing, you know, research, science, all of those things. And I think the four came out of like all my research, all the things that I read, because I realized these are things that I was sort of practicing already. I just hadn't like given them a title and said, oh yeah, these are the four parts of resilience. And like the four, if I can just quickly whiz through them, maybe that might help.
That'd be great.
So one is having it's faith, interest, purpose, and perspective. So I believe if you're able to develop yourself in each of those areas, maybe the most interesting one is faith. And so if you can get to a place where you believe, or you're of the mindset that if I keep doing all the right things, so in terms of like looking at things from different perspectives, controlling the controllable, putting yourself out there, getting out of your comfort zone, to be allowing yourself to be challenged, doing all of these things that put you in a place to grow, then you can actually have the faith that by doing that, even though today might feel like a rubbish day, if you keep doing the right thing, then you can hold on to the faith that it can only get better. So out of the four, that tends to be like one of my favorite ones, because we tend to just sort of take a snapshot on what is happening right now in this moment. But it's kind of like that piece allows the listener to take almost a helicopter view and say, actually, I am still doing the right things, and this will turn as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, it can be so easy to be swept up in the moment, can't it? So that bit of foresight and just taking some time to think about that is really interesting. Yeah, great. So how you've obviously done a bit of work in the diversity and inclusion sphere. How have you seen things change since you began doing this kind of work? Has there been significant change?
Yeah, so I think D&I, I feel like it has changed. So when, and maybe I could even go a step further back. So when I was employed in corporate in those IT technology roles for those companies that I used to work for,
Oh.
like these big companies, as you know, Catherine, they'll have like a D&I,
Lead
what they call
or
it, affinity group or
yeah.
like lead or some kind of process for handling D&I. Or some kind of way of bringing that community together. And so, like, one of my first experiences of D&I was, I think I was asked to chair the disability, it's called the Disability Interest Forum. Yeah, this was pretty early on. I was a graduate. It's probably the first time I heard about D&I. And so, and all it was, I think it was like a monthly meeting or like a bi-monthly meeting. And but we talk about it's pretty practical issues like, you know, accessibility and like, you know, having accessible toilets in certain areas, or if there's challenges using certain types of equipment, like introducing ergonomic workstations, all of those things, or even just welcoming new joiners who might have a disability, and sort of like inviting them into that community, and like I think there's a few socials as well. And so I think what the way that painted D&I for me was, it was almost like you have all of these groups of people. I guess, yeah, you could call them protected groups. You have people who have a disability. You have, you know, people of different sexual orientations, different ethnicities, etc. And to me, it felt pretty disconnected. It's kind of like, you know, the Afro-Caribbeans, they do their thing. You know, the disabled people, they do their own events, etc. And so that's how I thought about it until I kind of stepped into the work of D&I and into like learning more about consulting and learning more about inclusion. And actually, one of the things that helps me differentiate, you know, or understand it better is thinking about, you know, diversity as like the different pieces. So like, you know, the all those different groups that I mentioned earlier. So thinking about them, but then inclusion is how you make all of those pieces fit together. Because, you know, it's no good. I mean, it's great if we can, you know, for example, that forum that I was in, you know, if we could create a perfectly accessible building, etc., and make every person with a disability feel welcome is great. But at the end of the day, you know, even people in that group, they still have to work with and associate with people outside of that group, people who are not disabled. So for me, inclusion is that glue that holds all the different strands together, and actually feel like it's probably more of a focus area, or that it needs to be more of a focus area for organizations, because bringing the different pieces around the table on its own is not enough.
Yeah,
And
absolutely.
and I really like what I see in terms of inclusive leadership and people championing. I know the organization that I did some work before, and they basically, they still have their various affinity groups, but they also do cross affinity events so that you can get all of those people in the room and get them knowing different people and not just people with a similar background to theirs.
Yeah. I mean, the intersectionality piece is so key at the moment, isn't it? So, and I know at EW Group, we've seen so many clients come to us wanting to know more about intersectionality and really highlighting the fact that we're not defined by just one aspect of our lives, I suppose. So, I mean that brings me quite nicely onto what I wanted to talk to you about next, because we know that the Black Lives Matter movement has been in existence for several years, but we've really seen it pick up enormous traction in recent months. How do you, as a black man, think organizations will respond? And more importantly, how do you think they should respond?
Yeah, it's been interesting. interesting, and I think it's I think my view has kind of like and maybe will continue to kind of shift about this with time. And so obviously we had that situation, well, we've had a couple of situations this year in the US, but I think the big one that we all know about is the George Floyd one, in Minneapolis, and you know how that kind of, I guess, woke everyone up. I wouldn't say woke everyone up, but I feel like people, like, we've been aware of this stuff for a while, but it just got massive global attention, maybe more than ever before. And I think, yeah, maybe I can talk you through like where I was when it started.
Yeah.
So I initially, obviously, like, horrified that you could literally sit in your living room and watch another human being get killed on the street in broad daylight. To me, that was pretty galling. And I think I even struggled to watch the video to the end. I know it's getting shared a lot. I think it got to a point when I just felt so overwhelmed by seeing that image everywhere. And yeah, I think in the end, I had to even take a few days off, like, online and just, be disconnected. And then you had almost like the response to it, like the global, mostly outrage to what happened. And that's what that was, that felt right. We should all be outraged, you know, when an innocent person loses their life. So I was definitely feeling the same way as well. And then I think within that outrage, though, there was there was a little bit, I don't know if you noticed this, but there was a little bit of being outraged and also calling people out who don't seem as outraged as you are.
Yeah, definitely. The silence is violence kind of campaign or slogan. I saw that around. I mean, that was kind of a key message coming out, wasn't it?
Right. Yeah. And like, if you're silent, you're complicit and all of these things. And I think that, if I'm honest, that little bit, I could see the heart behind it, but it was a little bit frustrating because I don't think it fully takes into account, and this is maybe more from a personal level than a corporation level, it doesn't fully take into account how people just process trauma. So like for me, I didn't really, you know, as a D&I consultant, in theory, I should have been one of the first people to post my outrage on social media and say, you know, this is not cool, etc. But I don't think I posted anything for a good while. And not because I didn't have an opinion, not because I was complicit or anything like that, but just because I was traumatized, Catherine. Yeah, like, you know, I couldn't watch that video. I just needed time to let everything, like, sink in and for me to understand what that means, you know, for myself, for my community, for future generations. You know, I have like nephews and nieces who are younger than me, etc. So it's a lot to process. And people process at different velocities. So if you're able to respond in a meaningful and progressive way straight away, then great. But I don't think, in my opinion, that anyone should be shot down because they took an extra day to do a LinkedIn post or something like that. So there was that as well. And then I think what it's led to, I guess, now focusing more on the corporation side is, and I think EW, we've seen this as well, where it's just been like a bunch of requests for like D&I training, you know, workshops, etc., which is great. But I think it's great because, you know, even though there are some people say, oh yeah, like all these companies are just jumping on the bandwagon, etc. You know, this is a good bandwagon to jump on.
Yeah, of course.
First of all, it's a good bandwagon to jump on. And of course, there'll be companies and organizations who they don't want to be seen like they're not acting or they're being left behind. And maybe I think it's forced companies to also like really reflect on their people. I know like some of the requests that I've been involved in have been because employees and the workforce have raised that, you know, hey, by the way, to the CEO or the leaders, like what are we doing about, promoting, black women in the workplace, etc. And then out of that, it's led to more training, more workshops and more proactive steps in doing that. So so for me, from a corporation perspective, it is a good bandwagon to jump on. And I think, the big thing is that you want it to be sustainable. You don't want it to be another flash in the pan where
that's right.
It's kind of like, oh, yeah. And then the news story moves on and then we kind of go back to where we were, 4 or 5 months ago.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think, what we're seeing now from a lot of businesses and organizations is a real desire to make tangible change and kind of not just put out a statement in response, which is obviously great because at least then, it's a terrible situation and it's to have a positive come out of that. Thanks, Winston. That's really interesting. And a final question from me. What advice would you give to people who are looking to take that next step in their career, perhaps, or to get that next promotion or move into a new role, and perhaps they feel disadvantaged or like they're not ready? What advice would you give those people?
Yeah, good question. And I think, honestly, relationships are so key. And that's what I discovered as I sort of went up the corporate ladder. And to be honest, even outside of corporate, just in any business or institution, like relationships are so important. And this kind of links back to what I was saying earlier, entering a FTSE 100, company who hired me to be a programmer and feeling pretty relaxed because I knew I was a good programmer. And then actually arriving and realizing, there is so much more to the role.
Yeah.
And I think a big part of that gap was just learning how to build relationships. For example, because I joined as a grad, I wondered, in that first couple of weeks why everyone was rushing off to get a mentor, thinking, what they haven't assigned us mentors. So why would I go out of my way to seek a mentor? Like, just seems like extra hassle to me. So things like that, and just exposing yourself to different parts of the business. So like I said, I was a techie, but I had other people who were techies, but then they'd go to all these networking things for the sales team or for the trading team, etc. And then, put themselves in position to meet different people. And the reason why this is so important, I mean, it's building your social capital, right?
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about. And this helps down the line, later on you might decide to, or your manager, might move companies, and hey, there might be opportunity for you to follow them at some point, etc. Because you've built those relationships, you've gone out of your way to add value to people. And I think the challenge that I've seen sometimes, or I've experienced actually, is, because I come from an immigrant background or a background where, I didn't really know anyone. So I was first in my family to go to university. I was the first in my family to work for a FTSE 100 investment bank.
Mm.
So all of these protocol things that, hey, you should get a mentor, you should do networking, you should do this, that, the other, they were just not on my radar because no one in my family ever talked about it because they didn't know about it.
Yeah.
They didn't have the exposure.
Mm.
And so, that's what I try to give, especially to those people from a similar background who might not have had that education, in order for them to hopefully have an easier time of it than I did.
Yeah, great. Networking is key.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Winston. I know we are going to be working quite a bit together over the coming months. So
yes.
I'm very much looking forward to that. And it was great to speak to you today. And I wish you all the best.
I hope this episode gave you some ideas that you can replicate in your own organisation. We'd love it if you could leave a review and also subscribe to Reworked so you don't miss our next episode. Diversity and inclusion at work has never been higher up the agenda. The EW Group team includes learning and development specialists, facilitators, researchers and analysts, all with deep expertise in equality, diversity and inclusion. If you think we can help you rework your own culture, please get in touch.